Welcome to episode 132 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my guest is Aidan Jordan. He's a grant writer based in Southern California and a patron of the podcast. Aidan, welcome to Junk Filter.
Thanks for having me on, Jesse.
We're going to be discussing Philip Kaufman's 1993 thriller, Rising Sun, starring Wesley Snipes and Sean Connery. It's a murder mystery where the plot takes a backseat to the vibes, what I've referred to on the show as ambient noir. And for a movie turning 30 years old this year, there's a lot to unpack here about what the film has to say about issues that we're dealing with in our modern age. Beyond xenophobia and globalization, this film is also about digital manipulation that would influence opinion and hide the facts, and the surveillance state. And Rising Sun also displays an interesting disagreement between the filmmaker and the source material.
A detective, an expert in ancient wisdom.
Every aspect of your appearance and behavior will reflect on you and on me as your senpai.
That wouldn't happen to be anything like Massa now, would it?
A cop who learned his lessons on the street.
Senpai, apple pie, whatever it is you want me to call you. We have a murder here. I want to solve it.
You'll probably find them irritating tonight. Do keep your hands at your sides. The Japanese find big arm movements threatening.
Believe it or not, I have done this before. You know, I do know these things.
You come down already.
Yeah? Well, now I go back up. Maybe come down, go up 10 times more. We're still the police in our own country.
He's contaminating the crime scene. And I'm on his film.
We must undertake our own private inquiry.
Aidan, what pressed you to want to come on to talk about Rising Sun? It's a great topic.
Well, so there was an academic book published in 2015 called Surveillance Cinema, and it's written by Catherine Zimmer, who is the director of film and screen studies at Pace University in New York. And it's just a really fascinating, easy-to-read, provocative book that is basically positing that there was the cycle of the well-known paranoid conspiracy thrillers in the 70s that, you know, we all know, such as the Alan Pakula trilogy, et cetera. And then this big wave of paranoid conspiracy and surveillance texts following 9/11, such as The Wire and 24 and so on and so forth. And what's interesting about Zimmer's book is that she's actually really focused more on surveillance films of the 90s, including Philip Kaufman's Rising Sun and Catherine Bigelow's Strange Days. And so in her book, she devotes only, I think, about 6 pages to Kaufman's Rising Sun. But the film just, I had never seen it before I read the book. And it just sounded like a really fascinating and weird movie. So I was doing the Netflix DVD by mail at the time, and I rented it and I watched it, and I was just blown away by how just weird it was. And so I wanted to come on and talk with you about it. I think it's a strange movie, but also, like you said, really relevant to what's unfortunately going on today in the U.S. Geopolitical landscape.
You did something that I would never do. You actually read Rising Sun for the podcast, the book. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the book, because I know that Kaufman toned it down.
I had never read anything by Michael Crichton before. My fiance has read the Jurassic Park novels and the Sphere novel when she was young. And I have coworkers who swear by his book Timeline for some reason, which I haven't read, and I haven't seen the film adaptation. And before I read the book, because I'm most familiar with him from Jurassic Park, the movie, which is, you know, pretty tame and family friendly, I was expecting kind of like a bland middle brow book, but the book is really unpleasant, and the streaks of racism and xenophobia and misogyny are much greater in the novel. It was just a really unpleasant read. And the content of the novel and his writing style reminded me a lot of some of the stuff I've read by James Ellroy and Don Winslow and Frank Miller, where there's not really a lot of depth to the writing, and there's just this really big emphasis on venality and brutality and sadism. So it's a really unpleasant book to read. I wouldn't recommend it unless someone wanted to do a monograph on Rising Sun. But what made reading the book kind of somewhat worth it was to see the ways that Kaufman does tone all of this down, which isn't to say that what he does is perfect or even, you know, good, because any racism is bad and destructive. But Kaufman seems to have a much more gentle and compassionate worldview, and the ways that that comes through in the film, which isn't there in the novel, I think is really interesting for me to kind of see the contrast.
Though this movie is, you could go as far as to say racist, you could certainly say it's insensitive and stereotypical. I think there's a pushback from the filmmaker.
Definitely, yeah.
That is also, in its own way, simplistic, and he's trying very hard to get away from the very racist things this book is saying by putting those words in the mouths of disreputable people or having, you know, contrary sort of dialogue raised. But, you know, imagine a Japanese person watching this movie in the first place. One thing I couldn't find too much about was how this movie went over in Japan.
Oh, yeah, neither did I.
Yeah, I mean, but a friend of mine who was over there said that people just thought it was funny. They weren't offended by it. And I said, well, it's probably because they're used to seeing Sean Connery pretending to be Japanese.
From what, 1967 to 1993, he just had to follow up this.
Yeah, he had to do a follow-up. And he executive produced this movie, too.
Yeah, I mean, as you probably know, what's another thing that's ridiculous about the book is that Crichton based the character of Connor on Sean Connery. They had worked together on The Great Train Robbery, which Crichton directed and was based on his novel. But he couldn't come up with a more original name to signify Sean Connery. He just
John Connor.
John Connor.
Which is also James Cameron's property.
From Terminator.
Now, is the Sean Connery character in the novel, is he a racist?
Well, he's not really presented as a racist the way that Harvey Keitel's racist cop and Ray Wise's xenophobic senator are in the novel. But one important piece of the novel that is excised from the film is that near the end of the novel, Snipes' character in the film ask Connery's character, Connor, why he left Japan. And his explanation is that basically as a tall white man in Japan, he experienced a lot of racism. And when women in Japan would see him walking down the street at night, they would cross the street to get away from him. And so in the novel, that's yet another way that the racism that is in the U.S. and was in the U.S. in 1992 is placed onto someone else, rather than acknowledging the way that, you know, black or brown men are often treated that way in the U.S. Crichton felt the need to project that racism onto Japanese people in Japan in their encounters with the Sean Connery character.
This movie came out in the wake of the fall of the Soviet Union, and I got a sense, even in 1993, that this movie seemed to be America trying to find a new ideological opponent, starting to turn their eye towards the booming economy of Japan. I think one of the things that Crichton was inspired by when he wrote Rising Sun is there was a feeling in the early 90s, when Japan's economy was so strong, that their real plan was to sort of extend this new sort of Pacific trading zone, that eventually even Los Angeles would be swallowed up in, you know, an economic trading zone that was part of Asia, and that Japanese companies and individuals were buying up property in Los Angeles, and that this was all some insidious master plan to beat America at its own game and to transform our economy into a Japanese economy. So this film has a lot of dread about what the Japanese are really up to. And I don't think Kaufman was all that interested in exploring that. I think that he had to acknowledge that that's what the book is about, but he wasn't trying to make a movie about how we'd better all get ready for what's coming, which was how the novel ends, with a big speech from Crichton about how we really have to get ready for what's about to happen.
Yeah. Another thing that Kaufman cut out that's in the novel is that in the novel, Wesley Snipes, detective character, his position as part of this special liaison service, in the novel, his salary is entirely funded by a foundation that is basically a collection of Japanese companies who are funding this foundation to pay for his salary. And so he's in their pocket, and before the novel ends and Crichton has his polemical acknowledgement section, the protagonist says in this awkward interrogation framing device, which is also awkward in the film, he says, I've resigned from my position because I don't want my job to be funded by Japanese companies. It's time we take our country back. And so it's very explicit in the novel where, you know, Crichton is on all of this.
And also the big change between the book and the movie is that this is a murder mystery. And in the book, the murderer is Japanese. In the movie, they get you to think that that might be the case, and then they do a big fake out and the murderer turns out to be an American, although the movie also wants to run it by you that maybe you're supposed to think that the murderer was an American.
Yeah, in the novel, it is definitely Ishihara, who is played by Stan Egee, who kills Sherilyn Austin, and he's the one who is either thrown or falls into the vat of concrete cement. Whereas, like you said, in the film, it's implied that the yuppie American lawyer working for the Japanese company, Bob Richmond, likely killed Sherilyn Austin, but the movie leaves it up in the air whether he did it, or whether he acted alone, or Ishihara helped him, or if the head of the company helped him. I mean, there's even some implication that maybe Sean Connery's character knew all of this and was somehow involved. Kaufman doesn't care, which I think is interesting.
And they also insinuate that the American took the fall for this murder to make sure that this business deal that was all around this thing went through and wasn't stopped by this. I don't think Kaufman's particularly committed to that idea either. I feel like the movie kind of meanders to a conclusion, considering how watchable it is almost all the way through. It doesn't really add up to much by the end.
Yeah, to some extent, the efforts of Snipes' character and Connery's character to even solve the murder kind of don't matter, because in the end, no one's arrested. No one is held accountable for their actions.
So when this movie was being developed, Crichton was paid $1 million for the screen rights before the book was published. He was a best-selling author throughout the late 60s and into the 90s. Several of his films had been made into movies, including The Andromeda Strain and Coma, and Jurassic Park was on the way. This book was considered hot property. Several studios passed on it because of how incendiary it was. But Rupert Murdoch's 20th Century Fox bought the rights. CAA put a package together that included Crichton and his writing partner, Michael Backus, with Sean Connery as not only the co-star, but the executive producer, and the director, Philip Kaufman, in his return from European movies, European art housey kind of movies like The Unbearable Lightness of Being and Henry in June. What happened, though, was that Crichton and Backus left the project after a few months over creative differences. Can you tell us a little bit about what those differences were, Aidan?
Yeah. So in the novel, Wesley Snipes' character, who's the protagonist, he is a police detective for this special liaisons department, and who basically his job is to interact with foreign companies, foreign individuals when the LAPD is involved. And in the novel, his character is white, and his ex-wife is white. And Crichton was very upset that Philip Kaufman and the chairman of Fox at the time, Joe Roth, wanted to cast a black actor, Wesley Snipes. And Crichton's reasoning at the time was that there were no black detectives in this real life department. And so he and Michael Box thought it was absurd to cast a black actor based on that. And then also Crichton knew and said that once there's a black protagonist, that complicates Crichton's interest in basically presenting this conflict between the US and Japan when it came to both political and economic relations. It seems really uncaring, like, on his part, like, just no interest in you know, what minorities, you know, go through in the US on a daily basis at that time. Yeah, I mean, the film is better with a black actor, and Snipes is great in it. So it's for the best that they left the project.
And also, the LA riots had just happened a few months earlier when this movie was being put into production. So I think that Kaufman had a very interesting idea to complicate this black and white, if you will, narrative. Let me rephrase. Because I was like, black and white.
Well, actually, Jesse, that is exactly what Michael Bax said, was that he and Crichton had a black and white view of this, and Kaufman's view was more nuanced and more complicated.
In two directions, too, because Kaufman didn't want to make a movie about the America versus the evil wily Japanese, and he wanted to complicate matters by having a black cop. A black cop who speaks Japanese, and his entry into the story raises additional questions about how black people are treated in Los Angeles, the sort of the racial dynamics between black people and Japanese people, which Crichton didn't want to get into, and to show a more multicultural city instead of just having this be this binary argument about Japan trying to take over America, which I presume Crichton means white America. These are all things that Kaufman wouldn't have been interested in. Plus, Kaufman comes from San Francisco, which is a very multicultural city in America. And Kaufman didn't want to make a movie about the wily evil Japanese if he lives in San Francisco.
And the film directly addresses the U.S.'s history of racism against blacks and other minorities. I mean, early in the film, when Connery is very patronizingly talking to Snipes about the senpai kohai relationship, and is basically telling him that he needs to be subservient to him when they go investigate this crime scene with these Japanese employees. Snipes looks at him askew and asks, "Well, is this senpai kohai relationship like a master slave thing?" And then also I think really important scene related to this that Kaufman added was at some point Snipes goes to get his car so he and Connery can leave the scene of the murder investigation, and the yuppie lawyer who is working with the Japanese company really rudely and aggressively mistakes Snipes for the valet guy and says, "Hey man, what are you doing? Stop loafing, get the senator's car. We're waiting on his car." And Snipes has the great line delivery of, wrong guy, wrong fucking century. Crichton had no interest in even taking these little moments to show just the casual racism that minorities experience in America.
One of the things that made Crichton leave the project was that Kaufman kept demanding more and more rewrites. I think he got him to rewrite it five times by the time Crichton and Bacchus left. And then Kaufman brought in David Mamet to do a script polish. He's not credited as a writer. This movie does get by on some pretty good lines of dialogue. And wrong guy, wrong fucking century is a really good one.
Not in the novel, so I'm hoping that's a Mamet edition.
Maybe this is from the novel, you can tell me, Aiden, where Connery says, "The Japanese have a saying, fix the problem, not the blame. Find out what's fucked up and fix it. Nobody gets blamed. We're always after who fucked up. Their way is better."
I don't, to be honest, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I think that that is in the novel.
If I had to make it, it sounds like something from Ronin or Spartan.
Yeah, that very like staccato, you know, dressing someone down. I think I'm not sure. I don't want to spread misinformation. I know we're going to talk about misinformation, but I think that was in the novel. That line I love, where Stan Shaw's security guard Phillips is talking to Snipes' character about his ex-wife, played by Tamara Tooney, who they're spying on with the building surveillance equipment. When he says, "Oh, it must be really nice to fuck a lawyer rather than get fucked by one," because his ex-wife is a lawyer. I was really hoping that was a Mamet line, but sadly, it's in the novel. It's a Crichton line.
Oh, that's too bad. I think that Kaufman wanted to sort of change the subject a little bit with this movie. Like, there's no getting around how queasy the racial politics of this movie are, but Kaufman is more interested in movie stars being movie stars and character actors being character actors. It's almost like, okay, we got to sell this shit as hard as we can. Let's complicate matters. Let's have a black cop instead of two white cops investigating the Japanese. He was trying to muddy the waters, as I would say, and take away from the more strident points that Crichton was making. And I think ultimately probably made this a better adaptation than imagine the sort of MAGA version of this movie that could have been made. Like, if you were to make Rising Sun today, it would be probably made by the Daily Wire.
Yeah, Daily Wire, Daily Caller. Yeah, another big difference between the novel and the film is that in the novel, the character of Eddie Sakamura, who is also, I mean, he's presented as this kind of like wild card in the script. And he's also a wild card figure in the novel. But in the novel, he takes the laser disc that Connery and Snipes are looking for and basically, associates of the Japanese corporation track him down and torture him to death. It's really, again, like another instance of the ways that the novel is a lot more disturbing and lurid than the film. But in the film, he dies a hero. He chooses to sacrifice himself because he's so touched by Wesley Snipes' character putting himself and his daughter in harm's way to protect Eddie from the LAPD, who just want to kill him. They don't care if he's innocent or guilty or not when it comes to killing Cheryl Austin. He knowingly decides to sacrifice himself. And that goes along with, I think, Kaufman's general view that people are complicated, and Eddie makes the most noble and courageous act in the whole film.
Well, I love Cary Hiroyuki Tagawa. In fact, I'm getting ready for a big Miami Vice series on the podcast this summer. And there's an episode of Miami Vice starring Cary Hiroyuki Tagawa as a Yakuza gangster. And the episode is literally called Rising Sun of Death. So not only is he getting typecast, but he's getting typecast in things called Rising Sun.
Yeah, recycling, copying, pasting Rising Sun.
But yeah, I mean, he's really funny in this movie. He scans as a bad guy at first, but he sort of is sympathetic as the movie continues. Again, with Kaufman trying to complicate matters.
Rising Sun is smart, sexy, provocative entertainment.
To give this country away.
Nobody forced us to do it.
Sean Connery is one of the great movie stars.
Never underestimate your opponent.
And Wesley Snipes is right there with him.
We have a murder here. I want to solve it.
Powerful, gripping, intense, and intelligent.
You're to blame here.
The best picture of the year. Rising Sun, rated R. Now playing at theaters everywhere.
So, Aiden, let's talk about Rising Sun itself. This movie has a very discombobulating beginning to it. I knew I was in trouble at this movie from the very beginning, because you see the 20th Century Fox logo, but instead of the fanfare, you hear a man yelling as part of a taiko drum group. So the idea was actually a deliberate one from Kaufman. He wanted to confuse the viewer right off the bat.
Yeah, and that just where the score and the yelling is going on behind the Fox logo sets up from the beginning that there is going to be an element of cross-cultural exchange in the film, and that it's going to be complicated and messy. And then from there, there's an all black screen, and there are characters that in Japanese read Rising Sun. I checked with my friends who speak Japanese. And then as those characters, which are in bright red against a black background, are coming towards the screen, the image then cuts to a literal image of the sun. And then that fades out over an image of an anthill. And then while the camera's still on the anthill, you see horse's hooves stepping on the anthill. And then that cuts to this kind of Western setting. And there's a dog that comes out of like an adobe building. And the dog is carrying a severed hand. And then the camera moves up towards a man wearing all black Western garb, and he's wearing a black hat. And he looks like he could be Asian or Indigenous American. And he's looking towards the dog as it scurries off with the severed hand. And this all looks like it's on film, like it's supposed to be part of the diegetic world of the film. But then we pull back even further and we see that this is a grainy video playing on a karaoke bar TV. And the character of Eddie Sakamura, played by Tagawa, is singing a country song. And everything we've just watched is not part of the film. It is part of this karaoke video.
It's so bizarre because it starts off like a Louis Buñuel sort of directed a blockbuster. and the first 2 minutes of what we see in this movie are actually disconnected from everything.
Yes. But I think that's what's interesting is I was thinking of having seen this movie a few times now, I was thinking about how Christopher Nolan's The Prestige opens with, I think, Michael Caine's character saying, pay attention on, you know, there's that voiceover over a black background, and Nolan is letting the viewer know, you're going to have to do some work watching The Prestige. You're going to have to not take everything I show you at face value. And I think what Kaufman does is similar, but more interesting, because he doesn't have someone explicitly say, you know, you need to start paying attention to what you see and hear. He does that with this weird fake out.
For a blockbuster in the mid-90s, it's very experimental and off-putting. I don't think we even see Sean Connery for about 15 minutes.
No, and even before then, I think quite a bit of time elapses before we're even introduced to the hero played by Wesley Snipes. There's just a lot of ways that Kaufman was clearly not interested in giving the people what they want. I mean, there's not a lot of ass kicking in the movie. I mean, we don't see Wesley Snipes, who knows martial arts in real life, perform any martial arts until the very end. There's, Connery just has a few finger punches of death throughout the film. But yeah, if you're looking for a traditional 90s buddy cop action movie, you came to the wrong place.
Yeah, Connery's doing all these Vulcan nerve pinches.
Yes.
He seems like Spock when he's fighting the Japanese. He just touches them and they go flying or they pass out. You know, it's like, I don't know whether that's cultural. Are we supposed to take that this is part of the Japanese culture, that you can pinch somebody to death?
Yeah, it seems like another instance of this kind of questioning insidious view of Japanese culture, unfortunately.
So yeah, Connery plays a Japanophile, would be one way we could describe him. And it's not for the first time in Sean Connery's career that he's played a Japanese-obsessed gaijin. And for the show, you caught up to a Bond movie you had never seen.
Yes, Jesse. I mean, I feel like I kind of am like the Eddie Sakamura character, because first I sacrificed 3 weeks of my well-being by reading this awful Crichton novel, and then I sacrificed another night by watching You Only Live Twice, which I'd never seen. Yeah, it's that I was wanting to, in when I was watching You Only Live Twice, and there's that scene where James Bond undergoes this cringe-inducing, I guess, transformation into becoming a Japanese man. And there are these four Japanese women performing surgery on his eyelids, and he's given this very like straight-haired dark wig. I just wanted to run under my couch and hide, to quote Lex G. It was just cringe-inducing.
So what's so funny about Rising Sun is that we now have the return of Sean Connery acting like a Japanese guy.
Well, yeah, and then that's another thing. I mean, did he care? Did he want to sort of maybe make some amends or rectify this earlier
doubt it.
toxic portrayal? I doubt it too. I don't know if you saw, I sent you this this little interview from, I think, the Toronto Star, the Toronto Sun, where after Sean Connery passed away, Wesley Snipes said that Connery did not wear pants in all the scenes for Rising Sun. Yes. where he was filmed above the waist. I mean,
just, was that to make sure that they didn't get a full body shot of him?
I think he was just trying to be comfortable.
Okay.
But it seems very unprofessional. You know, Wesley, I'm playing this very Zen character. I need to be able to convey calm and mindfulness, and to really achieve that, I just simply can't be wearing pants if I don't need to.
When Marlon Brando was in Canada making that movie called The Score with Frank Oz, Brando didn't want the director to get any shots of his full body for any scenes. So to make sure that that never happened, he didn't wear pants.
Oh, poor Frank Oz.
I was wondering whether Connery was also conscious of that too.
I think he might have just not cared.
He was like, so anyway, so Snipes is brought in on the case. I guess we should explain the plot of Rising Sun. What's going on here, Aiden?
Well, here's a stab at it. So basically, the Eddie Sakamura character, who is shown at the start of the movie in the karaoke bar, he has a mistress named Sherilyn Austin, played by Tatiana Patisse. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right.
Tatiana Patisse is her name. Yeah. She was a German supermodel. Before we get too carried away talking about her, she passed away in January. She died of breast cancer at age 61. She doesn't have much to say in this movie, but she certainly is memorable as a beauty on screen.
Yeah. And after I give the little synopsis, I'll come back to some of the ways that I think she does a good performance when she's given, even though she's given so little. But basically, at the start of the film, Eddie is at this karaoke bar with his mistress, Cheryl, and she's just bored out of her mind because it's apparently 6 a.m. and they've been going at this karaoke bar for a while. And she storms out, and then he follows her out and is very aggressive and kind of controlling with her. And then we cut to this Japanese company in downtown LA is in a negotiating meeting. This Japanese corporation is trying to purchase this microchip company called Microcon. And we find out that there is a xenophobic senator played by Ray Wise, who is trying to block the sale because he doesn't think it's in the best interest of the U.S. to put their defense technology in the hands of Japan. The Japanese corporation throws this big gala in downtown LA at this big building, this big tower. And while the gala is going on, someone meets Cheryl on one of the floors of the company's building, and they start engaging in sex, and then the person who we don't see their face chokes her, and we cut to, we don't see her die, but then we cut to Wesley Snipes, and he's at home with his young daughter, and he gets a call to come in to investigate the homicide, and the call's from his ex-partner, Tom Graham, who's played by Harvey Keitel. And as Snipes is driving to the crime scene, he gets another call on his car phone to pick up this other detective who's also part of the same special liaison's service he's in.
He's like a retired cop, though.
Yeah, and so that cop's name is John Connor, played by Sean Connery. And basically, Snipes goes and picks him up and immediately sees that he's very immersed in Japanese culture. And then the two of them arrive at the scene, and it goes from there. We're all trying to find out who killed Cheryl Lynn Austin and why, and how is it connected to this this sale of this microchip company to this Japanese corporation. And the whole thing just seems to imply that the fate of the U.S. economy depends on whether this sale goes through or not.
So there's that soiree at the Nakamoto Corporation Tower, not to be confused with the Nakatomi Tower from Die Hard.
Yes, the Die Hard. Sounds a lot like Die Hard.
I liked something that you said in the DMs when we were talking about how this film alludes to other movies all the time. Like Nakamoto and Nakatomi are the same thing to me in my mind. So, and there's a big action scene in a boardroom in Die Hard, as well as the big sex scene in the Nakatomo Corporation in this film. But this film, considering how vibe heavy it is, it alludes to other movies too.
Yeah, Die Hard, and then also the boardroom kind of violence of RoboCop. Mm-hmm. Even though they came later, it also reminds me of Inherent Vice and Big Lebowski to some extent, where the mystery, like who actually killed this young woman, matters a lot less than the journey. And those films borrow from Big Sleep and Long Goodbye.
Connery is his character is also supposed to guide us through the inscrutable, unknowable Japanese culture. He explains to him the senpai kohai relationship. So Connery's like saying that he's the senpai. He's the one with the hierarchical level. He's the older person. He's the one with more experience, and it's his obligation as the senpai to offer counsel to a less experienced cop, the kohai. But one little faux pas about this movie's portrayal of the senpai-kohai relationship is if you're the senpai, you're never to refer to your junior as the kohai, because they would lose face. It would be like, if you were my kohai, I would be constantly calling you junior all the time in front of people. Like you're never supposed to do that.
I didn't know that. And also, I don't think Connor ever addresses Webb as anything other than kohai. He never addresses him as Webb, or his nickname Spider, or his last name Smith. He repeatedly just addresses him as kohai, constantly putting him down.
For a while, we're into the murder mystery, and it looks like it's going to get solved really quickly, because they get their access on a disc where they can see in the reflection of after the murder has taken place, they see the perpetrator going by a mirror, and we can briefly see the face of Eddie in the reflection. And so that seems like it's all sorted out. But as the movie continues, we discover that the video has been doctored by some evil, malevolent force out there has doctored the video. They've shown it to you because they want you to see it. They are in control of what you know and what you don't know.
In her book on surveillance cinema, Catherine Zimmer mentions that the film almost presents digital video as somehow being this evil, sinister, like Asian technology. And which is just, in itself ridiculous. But then also I think that the fact that we as the viewer, and Snipes and Connery as the protagonists, can't trust the video because it can be manipulated. I think that's where the film kind of opens up into this more postmodern element of the, you know, under late stage capitalism, it's hard to find objective truth. It's hard to, or nearly impossible, to find objective truth. In his book on Paul Thomas Anderson, Jason Sperb talks about how there are many ways to talk about postmodernism in terms of aesthetics, and he cites Christopher Nolan films as being an example of where postmodern aesthetics comes through in the loss of objective truth. And again, like I definitely think Nolan was probably influenced by Kaufman, his just refusal to ever present anything in the film as being straightforward and trustworthy.
But you know what I was thinking about in 2023 watching this film is that there's an extended sequence where they're talking about, you know, digital trickery and, you know, and tying the idea of digital trickery to these Japanese who will try and trick you with their technological know-how. But we're hearing that kind of bullshit rhetoric now with, you know, with the way that TikTok is spoken of as, you know, this evil Chinese plot to get all our data and to take over our lives. And, you know, you've got senators in very white states talking about how we're banning TikTok because it's some kind of weird technological Trojan horse from those evil Chinese. You know, so same as it ever was.
Yeah. And I was surprised to read in the LA Times that the this anti-Chinese fight against TikTok coming from U.S. lawmakers, it's not just the right wing lawmakers. I guess it's kind of a bipartisan thing where both sides are really intensely distrustful of China when it comes to TikTok.
One of the things that sort of bugs me about the argument that Crichton is making, and that we're hearing now with the way that the Chinese are spoken about, is it's of two minds, that they're talking about how, you know, they're trying to manipulate us and take us over. And, you know, we have to worry about our economy up against the powerful Chinese economy, or in this movie, the powerful Japanese economy. But there's also this begrudging respect for the fact that they can do this and we can't, and we should get better at doing what they're doing. Like they're you're getting those two messages at the same time. It's like, how come we're not the surveillance state?
Yeah. And as I mentioned to you when we were talking, there's more of that with Ray Wise's senator character in the book where he, you know, for example, he talks about how in Japan, they're more willing to conserve their resources, and that the U.S. is very wasteful, and that we need to be more like Japan so we could be on their level. And so there's this this admiration for Japanese policy, but also there's this need to dominate. There's this need to be on their level so the U.S. can be stronger than them. And I mean, that's really what any real racism or prejudice comes down to is needing to dominate and make lesser the other person.
Mm-hmm. In the mid 90s, when this movie was made, there were very protectionist messaging from the car industry in America about, you know, make sure that you're buying American. You don't want to buy a Japanese car. You want to buy an American car. Like, you know, this is a benign version of that sort of everyday hostility towards Japan that existed in the atmosphere that this movie was made in.
Yeah. Crichton's book was published 10 years after the killing of Vincent Chin in Michigan. He was an American citizen of Chinese descent. And, you know, one night he was on his bachelor party, just minding his own business. And these two Michigan auto workers, a man and his stepson, and whose the stepson worked for Toyota and was laid off by Toyota, they mistook him for Japanese and scapegoated him and beat him to death, and neither of them went to prison for it. It's just horrific.
Well, this is what I hate so much about that kind of rhetoric being thrown around by politicians and in the media, is that the people that carry out the vendettas are everyday people who have been misled by what they're reading and the sort of, and think that they've got the green light from what they read culturally. You know, that I'm going to, if the cops aren't going to do anything about these Japanese people, I'll do it. And then they kill a Chinese guy because they don't know anything.
Yeah. And I mean that, even before Trump was elected, I mean, I think a big part of his appeal to his base was he was China bashing and presenting China as being this threat to the US. And then during the pandemic, I mean, he and his administration were more than happy to fan the flames of Asian hate by trying to blame Chinese people and Chinese Americans and other Asian Americans for the COVID pandemic. Which you know, that scapegoating worked because then his base did not hold him accountable and his administration accountable for removing a lot of pandemic protections that Obama and Biden had put into place, and also just the general way that in the U.S. Profit has been placed before public health for decades.
Another thing that I wanted to point out, since we're talking about Rising Sun, is that the Rising Sun flag, which is the flag of Imperial Japan, I would say is the equivalent to the Confederate flag in the United States. We see more and more sort of nationalism happening in Japan. They fly the Rising Sun flag, the wartime flag, the way that American sort of, you know, traitorous Americans fly the Confederate flag, that it's the flag of losers, and they also fly it to trigger people. And I think that Crichton is sort of hinting at the evil nationalism of Japan by calling his book Rising Sun.
Yeah, which is a little hypocritical because his whole motivation behind the book was to basically be provocative and poke people in the eye, but also not overlook this type of nationalism and populism in the U.S.
When I was getting ready for this show, I watched an episode of Charlie Rose where he was interviewing Michael Crichton around the time the book came out. And Crichton was very sensitive to the idea that this book could at all be racist. And he was saying that he rejected the accusation that this book is xenophobic. But then he said that the impetus of the book came from when he took a trip to Asia and he returned to LA and landed at LAX and said that it was like he had landed in a third world country like Pakistan compared to how sophisticated and smooth everything was running in Japan. And that's what gave him the idea to write the book. But he doesn't want anybody to think that he's being racist, even though he's talking about LAX as being like Pakistan, like a third world country. These people don't hear themselves.
No, not at all. There was a pretty good Grantland article that came out. I should have written the author's name down, that came out in 2015 when the first Chris Pratt Jurassic Park sequel came out. And the Grantland author was mentioning that in 2015, which I think was 7 years after Crichton passed away, his literary legacy seemed really unsettled. And I think that's the way it is today as well. Obviously he was able to come up with, concepts like high concept, plot ideas in a way that had a lot of appeal, but I mean, stuff like this, I think really mars his legacy. I mean, to just, write something that was explicitly positioning the US versus Japan and not really thinking about how something like that, especially on like a blockbuster level, you know, can hurt everyday Asian Americans just going about their business. And kind of like how you were saying, I mean, with these US lawmakers going after China as an economic and social scapegoat, they're not really thinking about how that impacts, you know, Chinese American citizens and their families. And I guess they just don't care if they end up being the victim of a hate crime or hate killing.
Don't fence me in, just a turn of me loose. Let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western sky. Ooh, ooh. Oh.
Hey. we should also talk about this movie as filmmaking instead of just as pure politics. It's got a very, very strange vibe throughout. We had mentioned at the top of the show that it's sort of like an ambient noir, but it's not, I wouldn't call it a dude's rock film. And I think we should sort of elaborate on that a bit, even though it does have the star power of Connery and Snipes doing their thing. And the movie sort of luxuriates in the vibes of these guys doing their thing. It's not really a buddy cop movie to me.
No, I mean, their relationship is, I wouldn't really say entirely very positive. I mean, Connery's character is constantly telling Snipes what to do and criticizing him and condescending to him. And whenever Snipes' character is confronted with anything difficult, Connery's character is never supportive. I mean, in that scene where the yuppie lawyer mistakes Snipes for the valet and is completely just rude and disrespectful to him, and Snipes is justifiably upset and calling the guy an asshole, Connery's sitting right next to him and doesn't, you know, sympathize at all. He doesn't say, "Oh yeah, that guy's an asshole. He shouldn't have talked to you that way." He's just like completely unsupportive, unempathetic. And then later in the film, when this LA Times reporter played by Steve Buscemi is digging up dirt on Snipes and his former partner played by Harvey Keitel, because they were they basically accepted a bribe earlier in their career. Snipes' ex-wife is calling him on the car phone, threatening to take his daughter from him because of these allegations.
Connery slams his foot down on the brakes to stop the car.
The car comes to a stop, and Snipes gets out of the car and jumps over the hood of the car. And Connery very calmly basically tells him to come clean about this allegation. And then Snipes opens up to him and basically says that he and Keitel's character had responded to a domestic violence call, and they found a brick of cocaine in this baby crib. And at the time, Snipes and his wife were struggling with payments because she was pregnant or she had just given birth. And so Snipes and Keitel decide to take the bribe. And Snipes says to Connery's character, "You're the only one who knows about this besides my ex-partner." And he's really impassive. Like, he's not supportive. He doesn't come up with a plan of, okay, well, here's what we're going to do so you can keep your daughter and keep your job. They don't really build each other up in kind of a dude's rock way. And then at the end of the film, Snipes thanks Connery's character for all he's done for him. But then he goes off and tries to sleep with Connery's girlfriend.
I know. This sort of bizarre touch at the end of the film. Let's talk about another very strange scene that always stuck with me, is that sequence where Connery and Snipes visit that house where all these people's mistresses live. And there's a very strange scene where a young woman is talking to Snipes and they're alone together. And the way that Kaufman films the scene is, it's got this weird erotic vibe to it that comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, basically Snipes and Connery are at Cheryl Austin's apartment. And it's, the apartment is in a building where basically these Japanese executives keep and pay the rent for their mistresses. And the doorman is a Yakuza figure. And while they're turning over Cheryl's room, one of the mistresses from another apartment comes in and starts basically saying that Eddie had threatened to kill Cheryl. And if Snipes is Cheryl's backdoor guy, he should beware. And Connery's character realizes that she's probably been paid to say these things to them, and he walks out. But Snipes continues to talk with her, and she's only wearing an unbuttoned shirt and underwear. And he continues to talk with her, and she starts saying his name and laughing and is being kind of flirtatious. And he's just kind of has this glazed, kind of creepy look at her. And the film, the camera blurs and his face becomes really blurry. And then it cuts to another blurry shot, but he's now in the car with Connery. yeah, he's just very, very kind of like leering and creepy with women in the film. I know that Crichton had been divorced 3 times before this movie came out. And in the novel, Snipes' ex-wife is a lot more prominent, and she's kind of this negligent to the point of being abusive mom, which she's not in the film. But I don't know. It seems like Crichton had some, there's definitely some like a misogyny streak in this, and definitely in the novel. And it seems like in the film, Snipes' character is almost like, he seems to miss his ex-wife, and so he's like trying to get with these women, though it's, you know, one is a witness, one's his partner's girlfriend. It's just weird. At the end of the film, Snipes is dropping off Connery's girlfriend, who is basically the video expert that they keep going to look over the manipulated video.
Yeah, and she's the one who discovers that it's been doctored.
And at the end of the film, he's dropping her off at her place, which he realizes is Connery's place because he picked him up at the start of the film. And he's just really creepy. Like he's saying to her, "Oh, you're with Connor. Well, he's out golfing right now. I can come in, right? We're all alone." And when she gets out of the car, he puts his hand like as if he's gonna caress the back of her hair. It's just
yeah. And then the movie ends with her locking the door and then the door opening up.
Yeah, which goes back to the kind of the postmodern loss of objective truth, is that the film is constantly sort of rewinding and fast forwarding, and you don't know if he follows her up there or if he goes off and leaves her alone. And after there's the shot of the door opening on its own, it cuts to black, but then you hear Sean Connery's voice say, "Ko hi." And then you hear either, I don't remember if it's Connery's laughter or Snipes' laughter. It's just very weird.
And another weird touch in this film is that David Lynch's sound guy, Alan Splett, is the credited sound guy on this movie. And for all the really cool scenes of Snipes and Connery driving around with a rear screen projection in their car, the windshield wipers that are going are the sounds of a woman breathing.
Yeah. Which
I presume it's the sounds of the supermodel in the throes of ecstasy in the boardroom scene.
Yeah. I assume that as well. I assume that it was, Cheryl, who likes autoerotic asphyxiation, gasping during that scene at the boardroom. But what's weird is that that audio motif first starts happening when Snipes is going to pick up Connery before he knows anything about what happened in the boardroom, other than this woman's been murdered. But it continues like throughout the whole movie, I think. I mean, it's very prominent. And just another way that, Kaufman deserves credit for allowing Alan Spelt and Michael Chapman, who did the cinematography, just he really gave them a lot of leeway. I mean, he really was very trusting with them, very collaborative. I don't think something like this today would have a woman gasping as the sound of windshield wipers for a 2-hour movie.
Michael Chapman, one of the great cinematographers who shot Taxi Driver, he has a lot of fun with this movie. And I love the playful camera work in the scene where Snipes and Connery show up at Snipes' house and Eddie is back. And he's hanging out with his daughter in the bedroom and the grandma's there. And the grandma doesn't have any lines of dialogue. But Chapman keeps going back and forth between people these sort of dramatic zoom ins and stuff, like the things you're not supposed to do as a cinematographer is to like zoom in on stuff.
Yeah, there's
he's doing it.
There's a lot of zooming in that scene. And then also when Connery and Snipes go to this, I think it's like a little school where Tia Carrere, her character, who's the video expert, and Connery's girlfriend is at. There's interesting stuff with zooms where Chapman's camera is zooming on Connery as Connery is behind a camera, zooming onto, Snipes and Carrere. And you see that zoom on a video monitor that is in the frame as the actual camera frame is zooming in on Connery. It's just, yeah, very playful. Very fun.
Well, it's very clever. It's clever because this movie is about seeing and the act of seeing and how you can't necessarily believe what you see. So it makes sense that Kaufman would approach a film that has all this stuff, which they refer to as the gizmo, mm-hmm. in it, where they have they're zooming in on surveillance cameras and stuff. So, you know, in a way, Kaufman is making some sly jokes about surveillance and technology by making the camera movement apparent and obvious. That's the main reason why you don't use the zoom lens in a movie, is because it's so artificial. It takes you out of the movie. In this film, though, is so almost De Palma-ish in the way that it's obsessed with. We see the same thing a few times in surveillance footage, doctored and undoctored and raw material. And then hilariously at the end, we see the real footage when our heroes and Tia Carrere invade this business meeting that's going on at the Nakatoma Corporation and show them basically this snuff video. Kind of breaks up the contract signing. These people come running in and put a video of a sex worker being strangled to death on.
not what you want to see at a corporate board meeting.
But yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your thoughts about the surveillance culture that this film is warning us against.
So going back to postmodernism, Frederick Jameson had that really famous essay on postmodernism where he talked about the world basically moved away from Fordism and manufacturing to basically information technologies and information job positions. That was reflected in aesthetics. And so he wrote about how this emphasis on surfaces, replicability, and manipulatability comes through a lot in basically aesthetics like pop pastiche. I mean, the same way that Paul Thomas Anderson borrows from all these other filmmakers, and it's very explicit in his films. It is basically reflecting this emphasis on surfaces and text and reusing and recycling text. And I think that that's in the film as well, both in terms of its social politics and also its aesthetic. So there's this big emphasis on this move away from manufacturing and Fordism in the film. And that's kind of comes up when the security guard played by Stan Shaw is talking about how he used to work at a GM plant in Van Nuys, and now he's working for this Japanese company that is big into microchips and trying to buy this American microchip company. And basically under Fordism, you would have surveillance in auto plant factories, but not necessarily video surveillance or film surveillance. It would be like And the novel actually kind of gets into this a little more, where the security guard says that when he worked at the plant at GM in Van Nuys, there would be guys with MBAs who would come in and basically monitor the workers so that they couldn't mobilize to unionize or make their situation more humane or better. And in the film and the novel, the video surveillance is presented as a way of basically conducting this as well. And at some point, Connery's character says to the security guard, "Oh, I know that the Japanese really like to monitor their employees to improve worker efficiency," which in her book on surveillance cinema, Zimmer notes is just ridiculous, because that's displacing 100 years worth of, U.S. surveillance in the workplace onto the Japanese company, as if it's just an inherently Japanese practice, whereas the U.S. mm-hmm. had been doing that as well. And so I think that the surveillance is just another component of this, late global capital moment that the film was in and that we're still in now. It's another way to keep people in positions of oppression and also to buy into it. I mean, I'm sure my iPhone is probably recording what we're saying now and being shipped off to the U.S. government. So sorry, Jesse.
That's okay.
There's this kind of underlining element of precarity under late stage global capitalism in the film that comes up in different ways. I mean, for example, Snipes' character, he's a government employee, he's a cop and is a detective, and his ex-wife is a lawyer, but even with their government jobs, they're not able to basically manage their finances with a pregnancy. And so that's the motivation for him and Keitel taking a bribe in the backstory. And then with Cheryl, we find out in the film that she used to work at a Toyota manufacturing plant in Kentucky. And then at some point, Eddie came to that small town in Kentucky she was in. And then that was when she came out to LA with him and was basically his mistress. There's just this kind of element in the film of ordinary families being crushed by the inequality of capitalism that I think seems to be something that Kaufman cares about.
Yeah, that would be something that Kaufman would have introduced into the film as questions that Crichton wasn't all that interested in.
Yeah, exactly. Crichton just wanted to scapegoat Japan and Japanese companies for any economic distress that individual families face in the U.S.
And this is all what makes the movie so interesting to watch 30 years later, is like this ongoing argument in a way between the source material and the adaptation.
Yeah. I think it was an LA Times or Entertainment Weekly article one of us shared with the other, Kaufman talked about how when he was adapting The Unbearable Lightness of Being, he told the original author that he feels that he has to violate the source material. He has to really make it his own and put his own sensibilities and morals into it.
I think that is a completely valid thing. And I think that I think a true artist would recognize another artist's interest in disfiguring the original material to make it work for a different medium. I think that Kundera was probably fine with that, with Lightness of Being, whereas Crichton was furious about it.
Kaufman mentioned that in adapting The Right Stuff, Tom Wolfe was very supportive of his putting his own views and worldview into it.
Kaufman's attempts to sort of lighten the racism of Rising Sun with some more complimentary portrayals of Japanese people, it's still racially charged to me. It's like, I think that benevolent racism is also racism.
Still racism, yeah.
You know? When he has, there's stuff that he's sort of turned into sort of jokes in the film. Like there's a scene where Eddie is got some white women in his apartment or in his home. And he's one of them has like sushi on her and stuff like that. And Keitel gets off a funny line where he says, plundering our natural resources. Like, you know, that's like a groan joke. He thinks that stereotypes that are good are not as bad as stereotypes that are bad, instead of just trying to get away from all stereotypes.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I guess it's more a question for you to think about as well. I wonder, would the more thoughtful, more progressive change that Kaufman could have made, would that have been to have the Connor character not be Caucasian at all and have him be a Japanese detective? Or do you think that would just be furthering kind of promoting the othering that does go on in the story?
The way around it for Kaufman would be to, just like he does in this movie, where he sort of lightens some of the racist stuff in the film. Like at one point, the Keitel character talks about how, you know, our country's being sold lock, stock, and barrel. And Connery's character says, well, nobody forced us to. You know, like that's the sort of the lib sort of thing. Like, well, you know, you got to look at it this way kind of thing. One thing that I thought was funny in a review that I read by Jonathan Rosenbaum, he sort of liked Rising Sun, but he said that the contemporary critics were saying that the movie suffers a little bit because it's not as hard hitting as the book was and things like that. Like it's a little, you know, like they've tried to tone it down, but as a result, it's not as effective as it could have been. And Rosenbaum says, well, you know, they're very close to saying that they wish this movie had been more racist to be more effective.
Yeah.
He doesn't think that Kaufman's being racist in this movie. And he doesn't think that his fellow critics wish that it were more racist, but liberals have to hear themselves sometimes when they say things.
Yeah. 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 And that Rosenbaum piece where he also read the book after seeing the movie is really, really good. I did want to read this very short thing that David Thompson in the Biographical Dictionary of Film wrote about Rising Sun. He and Kaufman are bros because I guess they actually lived a few blocks away from each other in San Francisco for a while. They still might. But Thompson wrote, Rising Sun was probably too deft, too wry, and quick to be a hit. In the end, it was just a police story shadowboxing with the question of Japanese character and intent. Sean Connery's hero was a little too independent to be true, and finally the picture lacked pain or shock. This movie is also kind of in conversation with other films related to this this interest in U.S.-Japan relations and the hysteria regarding that. And have you seen Ridley Scott's Black Rain?
Yeah, like in 1989 when it was new. Never since though.
Yeah, so the in Black Rain, it's Michael Douglas and Andy Garcia who are U.S. cops, and it's been a while since I've seen it as well. And for whatever reason, they go to Japan, and in that film, Michael Douglas's character is also corrupt. But relating this all to what Thompson said about how Rising Sun lacks pain or shock, in Black Rain, which I think would make an interesting double bill with Rising Sun, one of those two protagonists does get killed by, I think, the Yakuza, and Douglas's character does have to face accountability for his corruption, whereas it seems like the movie ends with Snipes. Everything's going to be okay for Snipes. He's not going to be held accountable for taking a bribe. I think this film is more, like you said, toned down compared to both the novel and something like Black Rain.
Yeah, I don't think that Kaufman could go so far as to repudiate the source material in his adaptation. But there are some clear hints throughout the film, from the way that it begins to some of the choices about who gets to say this stuff in terms of the characters, that Kaufman's not on board with the whole idea of the threat that Japan presents the United States. And I think that the fact that he does some wacky screen wipes is another hint that he doesn't take this subject very seriously. Kaufman is a contemporary of George Lucas. Like, they're both based in Marin County. Kaufman wrote the story for Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I thought that it was funny that he incorporated some Star Wars screen wipes, that there are some scenes that end with the picture wiping over to the next scene that you associate with silly movies and funny movies. And the fact that he thought that he should use those techniques here gives you an idea of the contempt that he might hold for the plot.
Yeah, there are a lot of screen wipes. I mean, they're very prominent in the film. And I do think there is a personal element to the film, even if he does think that the source material is bad. He's always written about as being this maverick or outsider who is based in San Francisco and very explicitly likes to distance himself from Hollywood. And some pieces about Rising Sun basically posit that Connery is kind of a stand-in for Kaufman and his outsider status, and how he's kind of a roguish outsider. But also, I think he also identifies, I think, with Stipe's character, and the fact that Stipe's character is a family man. He's divorced, but he's still, you know, a present, caring, protective father. And Kaufman is a family man. I think maybe one of the reasons he stopped working was because his wife, who he worked on a few of his films with, passed away in 2009. And I think that was when the last Kaufman movie, his HBO Ernest Hemingway movie, came out. His son was also a producer on the film, A Rising Sun. So I think that Kaufman probably sides quite a bit with Snipes and Connery's characters, and Crichton seems like he sides more with Keitel and Wise's characters.
But, you know, we do have to, before we wrap up our conversation, talk about the most cringe scene in the movie, which is the scene where Snipes and Connery are trying to escape from the Yakuza's in their 50s, you know, automobile chasing them around LA, and Snipes drives into a South Central neighborhood to get away from them.
Yes, it's
that funny line. The line's funny where he says, "Tough neighborhoods are America's last advantage," but that scene is cringe.
Yeah, I mean, so I've probably seen this movie about five or six times, and the first time I saw this movie and that scene started, I was thinking to myself, "Oh, I mean, just based upon the editing and the camera work, I was thinking, oh, I know what's going to happen." Kaufman is going to come up with some elaborate way where Snipes finds some clever way to evade the Yakuza in almost like a labyrinthine, like maze kind of way. And it's going to relate to the way that Kaufman is showing the impossibility of cognitively mapping the reach of capitalism in this labyrinth where we're all under. And no, that doesn't happen at all. Basically, Snipes, who has been talked down to by the more dominant Connery throughout the movie, basically tells him like what to do as they're entering this South Central neighborhood, and he's finally the one who's in some position of authority between the two of them. And then basically, Snipes ask these black and some Latino and Hispanic men. I'm Mexican American, so I spotted that as well. He convinces these guys to basically harass the Yakuza, and so we have this terrible scene of basically black and brown
scary
men
black
coming,
people.
Yeah, coming together to harass these Japanese men. It seems like you'd kind of think that at some point Kaufman thought this was a good idea to maybe it's some way of giving Snipes' character more agency, who's, you know, really dominated by Connery in a lot of ways. But no, it is cringeworthy.
It says a couple of gross things. It like that, you know, that the black people all know each other, first
yes,
of all.
Yeah.
So like, so everyone's like, hey, it's, you know, he was a high school football player, or he won the Heisman, or he was up for the Heisman or whatever. So everybody respects him because he's an athlete, not because he's a cop. He's also a good cop. You would think that all cops are bad
yeah.
in South Central LA, but they love him and they're happy to help him, escape by scaring the Japanese away. These Japanese guys are like killers themselves, but all of a sudden they're terrified of black people.
Yeah.
And Sean Connery is like, one of them says, isn't there sort of a joke that one of them thinks that Sean Connery is Giorgio Armani or something?
Yeah. He grabs his like blazer and says like, oh, Giorgio, you're doing just fine, man. Cringe inducing.
And that scene, on a key note, that scene ends with a corny wipe, you know? So I don't know. It's like a comedy note out of nowhere that doesn't seem all that progressive for all the efforts that Kaufman's been making to lighten this movie and make it a little more reasonable. That scene is like sticks out like a sore thumb. So, Aidan, thank you so much for joining me for this show. Did you want to tell my listeners anything about what you do?
Yeah. I mean, I really appreciate you letting me come on and talk because I'm not a film journalist. I'm not a film academic. I'm a grant writer. I help nonprofits get money from big corporations, which is great, helping people. I did want to say, Jesse, and I forgot to mention this in the DMs, I did do some research following your Return of the Jedi episode, and I found out that Max Rebo survives. So there is a book. I don't know where it is. It's somewhere in my apartment. But there is a book called Tales from Jabba's Palace. It was edited by, I think, Kevin J. Anderson, and it was this book of stories related to Jabba and all the stories are by different authors, and there's one story called "And the Band Played On," and it is basically about Max Rebo and his crew in the short amount of time leading up to playing for Jabba, and then the short amount of time after the explosion. And they do survive. They jump off a barge or something, and they survive.
That's good.
But my fiance, who's a Star Wars obsessive, told me that. And all the other tie-in books and video games and trading card series are no longer canon as of Lucas selling Lucasfilm. So there was a long period of time where it was confirmed that Max Rebo survived, but now we don't know.
So I'm half right then. Since his survival is now non-canon.
Yeah.
He could have died on the sail barge.
Well, maybe Disney Plus just needs to give us the gritty Max Rebo origin story that no one asked for, and we can see what his life was like as just a, you know, hardworking, struggling musician before, and then see what Max Rebo was up to with the Jizz Whalers after the explosion.
That's amazing. I love any sort of follow-ups on some of the things that I raise in the episode. So you have determined that Max Rebo may have actually survived along with the other members of the band.
Yes, there was a period of time when he definitely did. Now, thanks to Disney, it's up in the air.
Well, Aidan, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Please come back anytime. This is a really good conversation. And thank you for getting me to watch Rising Sun again.
My pleasure, Jesse. And I forgive you for having me read the Michael Crichton novel, and I forgive you for having me watch You Only Live Twice. I'm like Eddie. I've just made all these sacrifices for you and your patrons.
On the next episode of Junk Filter, James Major is my returning guest, and he's the first person to come on for our summer sidebar series on the TV show Miami Vice. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you so much for your support, and thank you for listening.